Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What say you, Richard Ellett Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them, okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
Welcome to Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdochs, murders, money, and mystery. We are joined by our exclusive legal analyst, former South Carolina Attorney General Charlie Condon, our executive producer Drew Tripp. I'm your host, Ann Emerson, and we have a lot to discuss this week. We have several hearings that we've been waiting to find out about, how they're going to be moving forward, what's going to happen. We've been getting a lot of paperwork. I feel like I'm getting a bigger and bigger pile of paperwork every time I come out onto the set because we are still waiting for information about what is going to come about. One thing that we did just learn, though, is that there is a hearing scheduled later this week on Friday in Beaufort County ahead of the state's first financial trials versus Alec Murdoch. This is the first trial that they've been able to hold, and already we are having a motion hearing. Drew, can you tell us a little bit about why they're going to have a hearing this Friday?
So on November 9th, which we actually just found out about it yesterday, being the 13th. What has happened is in pretrial motions, Dick Harpootlian for Alec Murdoch's defense has filed a motion for a change of venue or a outright delay of the trial upcoming on November 27th in the Satterfield case in Beaufort County. This is the criminal trial for the actual fraud and money laundering allegations against Murdoch, specific to the Satterfield matter. That was scheduled for November 27th. Citing some preliminary returns on juror questionnaires, and I'll let Charlie explain a little bit about what those entail generally in just a second, but some questionnaires sent out to the pretrial jury pool asking them generally about their knowledge of the Murdoch sphere of cases. And according to the filing last week by Harpootlian and Murdoch's team, so far the answers to those questionnaires indicate, according to their interpretation, that there's no chance Murdoch's going to get a fair trial in Beaufort County or anywhere in the Lowcountry. And to follow Dick's line of reasoning, potentially nowhere in the state of South Carolina, unless you arbitrarily wait 4 months. wait just four more months, and then maybe suddenly they might get a fair trial then once a year has passed. I think it's not so arbitrary when you peel back the layers a little bit why they want that to happen. But that's the thrust of it. They're saying these initial questionnaires of the potential jurors indicate that most of them who have returned responses so far are aware to varying extents of the trial, and some of them even say they can't be impartial toward Alec Murdoch. And so given that, Dick is essentially going back to an argument he made in our last full court hearing back in September when they had the joint hearing with Corey Fleming, Alec Murdoch, and Russell Lafitte down in Beaufort County, where Harpootlian essentially made these same arguments that there's no chance he's going to get a fair trial with the jury pool. And yeah, so we're going to have a discussion on that coming up Friday morning, 10 a.m., Beaufort County. Juror questionnaires. Charlie, what Are they, it's pretty straightforward, but what does that process look like of, there's going to be a standard form, right, of a standard jury questionnaire that you just have to disclose anything that could prohibit you from performing your civic duty. But then in some cases there are extra questions that are added, and I think that's what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, you may recall from the original Murdoch murder trial, remember way back when?
Yeah, almost in 4 months, it'll be a year, to your point. Yeah.
So all those jurors came in, and at that point in time, there had been some sort of a questionnaire. We didn't know at the time what it was, but there had been some sort of questionnaire that they all sent in. And you could tell that both sides had this sort of base of knowledge. I'm assuming, I could be wrong about this, but I'm assuming that same basic template has been used for this Buford case.
Sure.
Because if you remember the specific items that Attorney Harpootly and Attorney Griffin were cherry-picking out of the questionnaires, they were like question 37, or question 38, this juror says this or that. So I'm assuming they're... We should be able to get a copy of this document, I hope, at some point to see what the questions were. But in this state, most in a lot of states, you have the ability to have a juror come up and have what's called individual voir dire, which you can question a juror on his or her beliefs about different topics and things. And it can be pretty extensive. We only have that in capital cases, and that's on a very limited topic, whether they can fairly impose the death penalty or not. So in this state, remember how they all stood up and said, who can't be fair, who's made up their minds.
In the double murder.
Yeah, in the double murder, mm-hmm. Whether they had too much of a relationship with either parties there, and they read out the witness list, that long witness list. We should see that again if this case gets underway in Beaufort County, a similar sort of process. But evidently what's happened here is these questionnaires have come in, and the defense believes that the questions, the answers are so black and white that we can't have a fair trial. Which, by the way, that is, in my humble opinion, Judge Newman has made it very clear, that's not the standard in South Carolina. The standard, in the Murdoch case, he said the standard is not whether you've heard about the case, but whether you can come in here and make up your mind based upon the evidence solely. And so some of those jurors are clearly disqualified, but some, I think, are in the gray zone. So the ability to have them come in and answer questions, I think, is, whether they can be fair or not, is still there. But I'm intrigued by how this is being set up because...
Right.
Whoa, we have so many things swirling around at the same time. Accuse Judge Newman, push this case off, the state's response. I'm sort of thinking if Judge Newman in his wisdom is having some sort of a get-together, so to speak, to calm the waters. And it wouldn't surprise me if there's some sort of announcement relative to his involvement going forward and what's going to happen time-wise. But we shall see. Who knows in a Murdoch case?
To the point where I think the attorneys will be asking him, are you planning on seeing this through? I mean, couldn't you just see Dick or Jim stand up and say, Judge, are you going to recuse? Just flat out ask. I mean, they can ask,
exactly.
Right?
In their public filing, they have this legal expert who says that for Judge Newman to preside would be a violation of the judicial code of conduct. And so I would think on the front end, they would ask the judge that our position is you shouldn't even be hearing this. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. But my hunch here is that Judge Newman has a plan. It's going to be a very good plan. We'll probably have to wait to see till Friday to see what the plan is.
Well, and we got this response from the AG's office that this was going to be about juror questions. Mm-hmm. Very specifically, when they wrote back to us, they said this is about juror questions. But he did... the AG's office did say that they would be possibly speaking about change of venue as well.
So
that
plot thickens.
The plot thickens, and if that opens up change of venue, then it's just it's like a domino effect. Because once again, I got a stack of papers right mm-hmm. here that say there's the defense attorneys have been working very hard at trying to delay whatever is supposed to be happening on November 27th. Which is this financial trial.
Right,
so
right. And put it in perspective, we've talked about this,
right.
But I think it needs to be reiterated to our listeners and viewers that here we're having a trial on something that this defendant has admitted to
right.
numerous times.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of the most unusual criminal trials I think I've ever even heard about in the state of South Carolina. Someone's going to trial on something that he's admitted in many venues under oath And the reason he's doing so, he wants to avoid the first strike on a three strike and you're in for life sentence.
Well, and to the point that Harpootlian even said in when they were asking to move, and to be clear, they were asking to move Murdoch's trial out of the 14th Circuit or to stay it for a year, because then maybe all of this, you know, all of this attention will start to die down is the idea. But he even says in the filing that, you know, they're waiting for a sentencing on the federal, right, on the federal plea, you know, that he's already pleaded guilty. He's expecting a sentencing in the federal courts. And then we know that he had a confession of judgment. And this is a case, the very famous case of the Satterfield sons, the financial case that sort of broke open this whole flood of victims, alleged victims of Alec Murdoch. So we've heard this story. I mean, I've sat in how many hearings now with Corey Fleming and Russell Lafitte and, you know, Alec Murdoch. We've heard this story over and over again. And at no point has someone said, oh, that didn't happen.
That's right.
Yeah. It is so redundant is the only thing I can think of.
Which, and that speaks again to the undertones, the underscore of what's happening here, the background to this all. And I really went over a lot of this in my written story on this last night. You can find that on abcnews4.com. You can find it linked on my Twitter profile. But I went back to that September hearing. We've had all these discussions before about the change of venue, the impartial jury, with respect to and delaying the Satterfield in all the financial trials. To Ann's, also to Ann's point about it being a case where they're trying to say, "Oh, we've already gotten the federal conviction. What's the rush? What's the big deal? What are we trying to do here? You're going to have your day in court." They also, to Charlie's point, Dick in that September hearing said outright, if they, being the state, would not pursue their individual trials and not pursue this three strikes, life sentence, felony convictions, and they would just agree to all, charge them all as one indictment and let us plead to one thing as opposed to each individually, that this would be a non-issue. They would already be, this would have already been pleaded out and there wouldn't be a trial. So as it stands, what's the context? We've discussed this before, Charlie. Their job, Dick and Jim's job, as Alec Murdoch's defense attorneys, is to get the best possible outcome they can for him. And even though what we know and what the whole world knows at this point is there's not a good possible outcome for him anymore. But it seems that they're somehow trying to hold out hope that if they can get this murder trial, get the murder convictions tossed, get the case back to trial in the murder case, or in the murder charges, get those back to trial, that conviction is vacated, the sentences are vacated, we go back to court on that. In the meantime, he's going to have his sentencing on his federal plea. He's already pleaded guilty. The only thing Murdoch has pleaded guilty to at this point is his federal indictment on fraud and money laundering charges. So if they can delay, kick the can down the road, throw up as many roadblocks as they possibly can, maybe there's a potential somehow that he could get transferred to federal custody and he ends up in federal prison as opposed to a state prison. And I lay out in my story yesterday that there's still, and we've discussed this on the podcast before, there's still, state has primary custody. State has the initial charge, the original charges predating everything the feds have done. It's a heck of a long shot that he's ever going to get out of state custody, I think, because he still has the outstanding, he didn't get bond on the murder charges. He would have to have a bond hearing on the murder charges if the case went back and was retried. Then he's got the issue of the $7 million bond on his original financial charges that he never paid. Mm-hmm. So is he going to get, is he going to get that bond waived?
Does he have a windfall something? Or, yeah.
Like, is that bond going to get waived somehow so where he can, the state will release custody of him and send him to federal prison? Are they going to go through a bunch of motion? This is, again, I think this is they're throwing Hail Mary after Hail Mary after Hail Mary here, it seems like.
Except if you step back and I think this is his ultimate goal, and they probably have discussed this a lot, is at his age, he's how old?
He's in his early 50s, so 53, 54.
They want to make this a lawyer who has had personal issues, who's stolen a lot of money from clients. Mm-hmm. We've had that before, not to this large extent. But if you make it that sort of a case, then the possibility of him getting out during his lifetime, I think, is high. So they want to undo the murder convictions with the Becky Hill process, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And which, by the way, the state, we can talk about this, of course, shortly.
Absolutely.
The state had a really strong response along those lines. But if they can get a retrial, I do think the ability of them to have a better presentation, shall we say, at the second go-around. Typically, I think a retrial benefits the state, but I think unusually in this case, I think it may and well benefit the defense. So if they can hang up the jury trial on a retrial, get the murder convictions undone. He's a lawyer turned bad on his clients, which is horrible. We've all talked about that, but he's not a murderer. And so he goes into all these systems, federal, state. So I think the likelihood of him being released during his lifetime would be high.
Goes up.
Yeah.
Substantially.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable.
So let's talk about this answer from the state on the question of the retrial hearing. It was written by a member of the AG team,
Johnny James.
Yeah, and there were two big things that I pulled out of it. Basically, one was the question of, well, why are we even having an evidentiary hearing? Why should we be having, you know, kind of raising that question? And then, of course, then we see all of this information that comes out of this answer, this response from the state, including the first time that we've heard from the Colleton County Clerk of Court, Becky Hill. But before we get to that, for James to write about the evidentiary hearing even taking place, is that a question, Charlie? Like, wasn't that something that came down from the Supreme Court?
I was a bit surprised by that lot of argument, because I thought the order from the Court of Appeals was that there shall be an evidentiary hearing. And I thought it was, that's kind of a language, but maybe I didn't fully appreciate the fact that it still may be discretionary with whoever the trial judge might be.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he thinks he can, and might as well argue that point because it might be granted by the trial court. But I think that would then be another issue that goes back to the Court of Appeals if there's not one. I think the more likely scenario is there is going to be some sort of an evidentiary hearing. So his I think, more salient point was, if we're going to have such an animal, such a hearing, keep it very limited. Only have the judge ask questions that to the jurors. Have you been unduly influenced? Did the clerk say these things to you? Sort of a judge-driven with no cross-examination. Of course, that would be a very short hearing, relatively speaking. I've got to think the defense is going to fight that tooth and nail, wouldn't you think, Drew?
Yeah, and that speaks to something that we've touched on several times here, is when you, in our analyses of the original motion, dating back a couple months at this point from Team Murdoch, it's, for all its scandal and everything that goes on in that, it's a very narrow question at the end of the day. And I think the AG's office, Assistant Attorney General James, he does a good job of cutting through the distractions there and getting to that point. Getting to your point of, like, should we even be having a hearing, I don't think that the state has necessarily been as decisive as it would like to have been in showing that there is no reason for a hearing, at least a hearing. because they make the point that, oh, well, and these are all very, very valid points. They make the point that if you look at all those four affidavits that Murdoch's team originally submitted, two of them, the people didn't even sign themselves. They're technically hearsay affidavits from Holly Miller, the paralegal. The affidavits were technically hers. They're not signed by the individual jurors, and they're sworn by her individually, and the state makes the point that's hearsay, and they're not admissible, and they've moved to strike them. They don't want them included. Then the third juror affidavit was from the egg lady, who was removed, didn't participate in any of the deliberations as to Murdoch's guilt or innocence. Therefore, what she has to say on the matter is largely irrelevant, and she has strong motivation to, because of the spectacle that's been made of her, rightly or wrongly, but she has motivations based on her character and behaviors being scrutinized. She has potential motivation to strike back at the state and the court and say some things that are worth taking with a grain of salt. That leaves one juror affidavit, the one juror, juror 630, who had something to say about what she witnessed, what he or she witnessed from Becky Hill, from the court staff, and everything that went on, and saying, yes, there was some suspicious, if not, questionable behavior by the clerk in the instruction she was giving the court. And to that point, the state, I thought, did a good job of pointing out the weaknesses and failures in the other affidavits and how they don't really bring anything actionable to the table. But at the same time, they also bring a checklist of, they've gone out and interviewed all the other jurors now, or most of the other jurors, some refused to speak. They've gone out and interviewed all of them now, and they're saying, yeah, I think I remember Becky saying something about watch his body language. Three different jurors that were not part of the original four affidavits from Murdoch's team, three interviewed by the state, now say, I remember Becky saying something about body language.
I don't want to necessarily pick up the ball here for the defense team, but if you step back from this, one of the things that struck me about Becky Hill's affidavit was, first of all, the timing. Mm-hmm. Elected official, she was accused of all these horrible things. How long ago? Was it a month ago?
September.
So and she has two very highly qualified criminal defense attorneys. So think of that scene. They meet with her. If she did nothing, and I'm not here to condemn her in any way, I think highly of her, but if she did absolutely nothing wrong, you'd have a press conference the next day, right?
Yeah.
And just go and after.
And a lawsuit for defamation
and
libel.
Just get going there. So I have to think that at some level, there was some questions or some concerns about what she in fact did do. And here we've had with the state's motion, where they did talk about, well, she said, watch her body language. Now,
well, so if you look at what 630 actually said in the affidavit from Ms. Hill, if it does talk about, I did not instruct the jury to look at his movements. It does not talk about body language.
Okay.
In juror 630. So.
Well, wouldn't that be the same side of the coin, though? Like, watch him closely, look at his movements. Wouldn't movements be akin to body language?
What does the juror say relative to what Kirk Hill said that on the state?
What does the juror say in 630? I can look it up. Yeah. But with the body juror. Language is, it's just the language is a little different, mm-hmm. It seems like. But so it adds to the, like, he said, she said part right. of this.
But am I correct that one juror, if not several, said that the clerk said something to them about body language? So stepping back from that, having tried a lot of cases in this state, to have a clerk of court say anything
right.
to a juror about what's going on in the courtroom is just highly, highly improper.
Well, and this is my question to you as well, is what is the... what is the bar that is raised with a clerk?
That's a great question, too, because I haven't done the extensive reading about this, but I have read a lot of the cases involved with this, and there are really sort of two lines of thinking with the court. One is sort of a harmless error analysis, which in this case would come to the fore, like, right away. Mm-hmm. Like, of course, there's so much evidence, it's harmless. But there's another line of cases that talk about the sacrosanct nature of the jury system, mm-hmm. and to have public officials impugning upon that very directly, that creates a very unacceptable level of behavior that could result in a new trial. So I don't know what our Supreme Court would do, and I don't know what whether Judge Zuman or some other judge, what standard they would apply. But I would say this, that if you look at her affidavit, and not to criticize fellow members out there of the media, but they took the bait, so to speak, like clerk denies, allegation
denies. Yeah.
But she didn't.
Right.
Because if you look at her affidavit, she went piece by piece on the affidavits of the jurors that the defense had and did deny those in large part. But she didn't deny the affidavits that what the state was saying relative to just what you talked about, like let's look at the body language. And so I think they've got a little bit of problem, not a little, I think they've got a big problem on the state side, that you've got some issue there that is very substantive. This isn't a minor issue. You've got a clerk of court who has put herself as really a public figure here now with her book publishing and in the middle of all this. And it appears, at the very least, correct me if I'm wrong, if you distill everything, that at the very least we do have her, the state admitting that there was something that they wish she hadn't done. Yeah. Let's put it kindly.
And so we get past all that we've talked about. So what does it come down to from the state's perspective? He leads off by saying, the motion fails to show Murdoch is entitled to an evidentiary hearing or relief because this ultimately boils down to a single, quote, constitutional allegation, which is that Clerk Hill told jurors not to believe the defendant and thereby violated his right to an impartial jury. Again, goes on to point out that only one juror polled so far has said that, and that was Juror 630. But Juror 630 also ultimately said, I was influenced by other jurors, not Becky Hill. And that is a point we've made several times, and it's a point that they rely on heavily here. And again, Juror 630's specific allegations in their affidavit was not to be fooled, watch him closely, look at his actions, look at his movements, which I would say is kissing cousin to body language, things like that. It's close enough that when you take it in context of what these other three have said, from the state's investigation, still it raises an issue. But they say that's still, end of the day, irrelevant, because that is, we have here, the juror who is making that claim is also saying, they're also saying that they weren't influenced by
that. Right, didn't matter to them.
And so that's
what that is going to be the
end of the day,
thing, isn't it?
Yeah, whether yeah, if you, I think that's, what's the standard here? Can you
right.
Can you mess with the jury, so to speak, if you're the clerk of court? If they say at the end of the day, well, I still would have decided this way, or if you're saying some things to them, that's per se, that's enough to overturn. Wow,
and
a six-week
like
trial. That's the thing that's so just,
I
keep going
just
back to this. It's like, it's unfortunate this has happened.
Well, how long did it take to get it through all of the financials on the six-week trial? Was it 1 week, 2 weeks?
It was like maybe a week, 10 days.
It was a good chunk of February. I remember that.
Yes, exactly. So what if our defense team figures out a way not to include that, then that's going to shorten the trial time.
Actually,
you lose that mini trial within the trial.
That's true, too. A couple of thoughts on that, too, I've had a lot of retrials, maybe fortunate and unfortunate as a prosecutor. And typically you know what the defense is going to do, and so you're geared for that. I think it really benefits the state. I think in this case what's so different about this is, remember how, first of all, there was no sequestration of witnesses. That means that the witnesses weren't forced out of the courtroom with the testimony. And I actually always thought, I was kind of really stunned by that the defense didn't move them out of the courtroom, because the state's presentation, all, like, I think of my friend Kenny Kinsey sitting there looking at their witness, what their defense witness testified to. He knew what exactly. Mm-hmm. In your typical murder trial or a high-profile trial, or really most trials, you don't have that. The jurors, the witnesses are sequestered. They have no idea what the other person is saying.
Right.
And so the smoothness of the presentation, I thought was really, really smooth, and was enhanced by that aspect. And I'm not so sure the defense, of course, they'd benefit too, but I thought theirs was sort of choppy on the expert side. And then I do think you mentioned maybe they can keep the financials out, but I think the more likely question is not having the defendant testify. I really thought that case got much stronger by the state with the defendant Murdoch testifying.
Great point, because that's actually something that the jurors that did talk that went on to the Today Show when they flew up there with Ms. Hill, they said that one of the biggest issues was the fact that he testified.
Oh, yeah.
And that can be easily rectified.
Yeah,
he did. Now you just don't talk. He didn't have to talk. And he I don't think he would make that choice again.
Yeah, that to me was another thing. I don't know if you remember this or not, but remember there's a lot of stipulation of exhibits. Remember that big, thick exhibit that the state had on all the PowerPoints? It was that witness, I forget his name now, this lady did a great job, but he had a thick document that the state stipulated to, I mean the defense stipulated to, that had all this forensic information there. He had such a smooth testimony on that, and that document came right in. So I wonder if they're going to rethink that. No, we're going to make you, it would extend that, that would have extended that trial by at least another 2 weeks, just on the chain of custody type boring witnesses. And if I'm the defense, I'd make this a long, boring trial going into like three, 4 months.
You just don't even, the jurors can't even see straight. Yeah, by the
end of that. It's much more of a mess. So we'll see what happens on, if there is, in fact, a retrial. But again, playing the long game for the defense, I do think they really do think that if they can get a retrial, they get a good shot of a hung jury on the second go-round, and then he's a lawyer that's gone bad. And we unfortunately have seen that in South Carolina before, not to this great extent. But those lawyers get out. They're not going to spend the rest of life in prison. That's why I think the Attorney General's office is flipping back to the three strikes and you're in for life, because that is the kill shot. If they get that, three easy trials, each will take less than a week, and he'll be sitting in a horrible South Carolina prison literally till he dies.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
So he wants to avoid that.
That's their insurance policy. And you said that literally from the moment that we met with the prosecution, what was it?
I know.
A week or two weeks after it? That was like literally the headline you took out of that whole thing was they were going for three strikes. And they needed that insurance policy.
It looks like it may be, I hate to use the word necessary, but because the federal... We've talked to this before, but I mean, the federal government getting involved with this, I think it has unnecessarily complicated the situation, because the amount of time they got in federal court, what was it? It wasn't terribly much. 5 years, 7 years?
Lafitte got 7 years, and then Corey Fleming got 3 years, 10 months, in which we know he'll serve 3 years, 3 months due to the 85% federal rule. So plus the third. Plus the effect of 13 years that he got from the state, but the federal sentences, aren't terribly.
And Murdoch, where does he stand on the federal side?
He's not been sentenced. He's pleaded.
And what is he facing under the guidelines?
They've intended to pursue the maximum sentences, and he faces 30-year sentences,
which would be effectively.
He's in his mid-50s.
Is that a parolable one? Of course, no parole in federal court, 85. So, so maybe what they're thinking is we can get him in the federal, but I think he'd much rather prefer to serve his time in federally and then still get out when he's alive.
Yeah, potentially, yeah.
So it's a super complicated legal situation, a moving target, and we'll see where this goes.
So I guess this is where I'm wondering where this goes right now. So we know that we're going to have a hearing on Friday. At that hearing, we're probably going to decide... we're going to hear about these juror questions. I'll be interested to hear if they're going to actually sequester this jury and whether or not that's playing a role in all of this as well. So we should learn more about the juror questions, what's going on. As far as how effective the defense's argument is with particularly Judge Newman, as far as saying that we want to change a venue and we want... And or we want just for you to say it just for another year, just let it ride. They've got this federal sentencing, all of this that's going on in Murdoch's different criminal cases.
It's something. Yeah.
We're going to get information on
maybe
Friday.
This is part of it. When is the federal sentencing set for him?
It's not set yet, but it'll be 2024. It will not be this year.
Is that right?
It will not be this year. I spoke to Emily Limehouse with the U.S. Attorney's Office a week or so ago.
Yeah.
On the federal side, they, for any criminal case at the federal level, they have something called a pre-sentence report, where the U.S. Department of Probation and Parole, they assign an investigator to review the facts of the case, review the trial,
right,
what took place, and then they come up with sentencing guidelines for, and they present their recommendation to the court, and then the two sides, the defense and the prosecution, write their own memo and their rationale and what they think the sentence should be. And that process takes a long time. We know with Russell Lafitte, it took until August 1st of 2023. He was convicted a little under a year ago, November 22nd, 2022, or November 21st, 2022. Mm-hmm. I remember. But
that's right.
It took a little
I need to look into that. That could
that.
Be part of the chess piece here, because there's no parole in federal court, but you get some time off, I think, for good behavior. So maybe what they're thinking is another chess piece here. Mm-hmm. That if we get him on the federal side and we're down the state side, that he might be able to live out his sentence in the federal system. That could be part of the long game.
That's what I was sort of getting at. And I mm-hmm. think you still there have the bond issue, potentially, going all the way back, and will the state relinquish custody with mm-hmm. original or primary jurisdiction with the original charges and things? But I don't know if then do convictions then supersede charges at that point? So if his murder charges get vacated, then the only conviction against him standing is his federal conviction. Does that then somehow make him give the feds custody, primary custody? It does it even work that way? I don't know enough about that, so I don't want to speculate. Charlie, you can.
Yeah, I actually looked into that because it's actually a very gray area.
Yeah.
I think he's considered a state inmate. They have primary custody, and they can keep him. But if the federal government wants to fight for him, they've got a shot at him. I don't think they want to fight for him at this point.
No, we have not gotten that. Mm-hmm. That has not been the feeling from Limehouse and the attorneys over there, U.S. attorneys. When we were dealing with all the asset seizure and how, Dick and Jim were like, we need the feds to come in and seize these assets because they're not being allocated proper or, allegedly, all this kind of stuff. And U.S. attorney's office was like, nope, we're good. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do that. We are not dying on that hill.
Yeah, that was very surprising.
Yeah.
That's something we've not even really discussed on this. It's worth a few sentences, but what's happening with Murdoch's assets. When the federal government said, yeah, we're not playing ball with you on that, we're not going to come in and try and swoop and take away what the state receivership attorneys, all that money and funds they seized. While this has been going on, there was a deadline that passed at the end of October for basically anybody with a claim against Alec Murdoch's mm-hmm. remaining assets to get those claims in. And I reviewed most of what has been filed so far. I think everything that's been filed so far. And I mean, it just really puts into perspective the final accounting from the receivers, the court-appointed attorneys in charge of marshaling Murdoch's money, keeping track of what goes in and out, making sure nothing gets wasted, hidden, squirreled away. Those guys, their final accounting after a fees and everything else and paying off debts and other stuff like that, he's only got $1.5 million left. And then, oh, by the way, they're going to have to pay a special referee out of that, again, I think, to mediate and divvy out all the assets. You compare that $1.5 million that Murdoch has left officially to his name, and you compare it with some of the assets, some of the claims, like good.
Oh, 40 million?
I think it was the Badger case.
Yeah, the Badger claim went up to 40.
$40 million that they said their claim would have been worth had that that case been taken to trial for the civil case. That alone, we're talking tens of millions of dollars from the Beach family. There's just, it's going to be interesting to see how that comparatively, and I don't say this like $1.5 million for anybody listening to this or sitting here, that's life-changing money. But when you've got to split it up about eight different ways with people who have verified and legitimate claims against it, and their valuations on what they're actually owed versus what he has left, it's just really astonishing to that point. I just wanted to touch on that just generally. But that's all happening in the background. Sometime, I think, around February is when the final decisions are going to be made on what happens to that money.
Well, and so I guess finally is we don't know when the evidentiary hearing is going to be held. Is there any way that we think that Newman would broach that subject while we go into the hearing? He seems to like to schedule things. You know, like when we've gone in there, and he likes to bring everything together. Like he, you know, I've been in several hearings now. We've been in several hearings where they brought a lot of different cases together. So, you know,
I think there's a good chance that's going to happen this Friday.
So we may get more answers. Is the final thought here? And one of those is when this evidentiary hearing, which is a retrial hearing on the double murders, is actually going to take place. So we will have more answers for you at the end of this week, we think. Mm-hmm. And when we do, we'll come back and we'll report on it. But for now, thank you so much for joining us. And please stay with abcnews4.com with our Twitter handles, with Charlie and Drew and myself. And we are going to try and keep you up to date on the latest. I think things are going to start moving very quickly, possibly because of the holidays. They're going to want to get some answers, so we will let you know what happens. Thanks for joining us.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Allow your imagination to be piqued by stories that are brought to life through captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. As an Audible member, you'll be able to keep your heart rate up month after month because you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. If you're in the mood for a shocking psychological thriller, check out None of This Is True by Lisa Jewell. Embrace brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.